Welcome to The Sanctions Age, a podcast that explores how sanctions are changing the world. My name is Isvander Batmanghelidze. Today's show is about how countries targeted by sanctions try to circumvent and undermine those measures. The stakes around sanctions evasion have never been higher. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has made sanctions circumvention a matter of life and death, as Russia continues to use export revenues to fund its war economy. Despite trade restrictions, Russian factories continue to churn out weapons using imported parts and machinery. Meanwhile, growing antagonism between China and the United States has spurred Chinese officials to worry about their vulnerability to U.S. financial sanctions and to therefore question the dollar's dominant role in the global economy. While the stakes are highest today, my guests have been working on these issues for over a decade. Daniel McDowell is an associate professor at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. He is also the author of Bucking the Buck, U.S. Financial Sanctions, and the International Backlash Against the Dollar, which was published last year. Daniel, thanks for coming onto the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Maria Shagina is Diamond Brown Research Fellow for Economic Sanctions, Standards, and Strategy at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Maria, great to have you.
Thank you for the invitation. Yeah, glad to be here.
So I want to start with some definitions, because on today's show, we're talking about two different but related concepts. The list of countries targeted by Western sanctions and export controls is growing and includes two major economies now, Russia and Iran. It's conceivable that China could find itself on that list at some point in the future, and this has spurred policymakers in a wide range of countries to try and circumvent and undermine sanctions, especially U.S. financial sanctions and related export controls. Maria, how would you define sanctions evasion?
Sure. Sanctions circumvention is a big term right now, is a big bucket list for Western countries. The terminology refers to legal and illegal way of avoiding compliance with rule and restrictions. So it's an umbrella term that includes both evasion and avoidance. So evasion is something that is illegal activity that represents a violation of the law. The underlying motivation here is deceit, misrepresentation, and concealment. And avoidance is actually a legal activity within the legal framework where actor probes for the loophole within the sanctions regime. So it's more of a breach of the spirit of the law. So quite often in media landscape, you see headlines that say that this or that company violated sanctions. But if you dig down into details, quite often is actually sanctions avoidance where circumvention is done by poor design. So one type is circumvention through enforcement and one through porous design. And if we zoom in on Russia's case, there are plenty, obviously, examples of sanctions circumvention, both types. But if we zoom in on the shipping industry, that is something that Russia learned from both Iran and North Korea how to do so. It's a quite multifaceted endeavor, if you want, which includes creating a shadow fleet, all tankers that are usually 10, 15 years old, the tankers, using flags of convenience, purchasing insurance from exotic jurisdictions, also using ship-to-ship transfers in open waters, blending, spoofing. So all types to really conceal and deceive what is being purchased and where the end user is supposed to be.
This makes me think that we need a dictionary of sanctions evasion, because there are all these new terms, blending, spoofing, you know, dark fleet, that have come into sort of parlance in recent years as this phenomenon has become more prevalent. Daniel, Maria just described kind of sanctions evasion as this, you know, short-term response. It's the immediate response to the sanctions pressure. But it also, it's becoming increasingly clear that countries like China and Russia are thinking long-term about their vulnerability to continued pressure from Western governments through financial sanctions and other measures. And they are potentially seeking to undermine the role of the U.S. dollar and maybe to an extent the euro in international trade. Tell us a bit about this phenomenon of de-dollarization. I mean, what does that mean?
Well, to begin with, maybe it's worth briefly sort of summarizing that the world economy runs on dollars, right? Most of the world's wealth is invested in dollar-denominated assets. So we're talking official investments, 60% of foreign exchange reserves. roughly. The next closest competitor there is the euro. That's around 20%. And so that last 20% is divided up among another five or six less important currencies. So the dollar, we know, is the world's premier store of value. It's also the world's most widely used currency for cross-border payments. So that includes things like settlement for trade. And around half of all cross-border payments in the world today are conducted in dollars. Something like 85% of trade credit is dollar denominated. And so, you know, there really are no competitors remotely close to either of those levels. So we talk about dollar dominance or dollar preeminence or dollar hegemony, whatever term you prefer. Those are the things that we're talking about. So by virtue of the fact that the dollar is sort of dominant in these various areas, the United States is able to derive some significant coercive capabilities from that. It knows, for instance, who holds dollars and where those dollars are held. It knows who is making or receiving payments in dollars and through which banks those dollars are flowing. And if it chooses, specifically if the sitting president so chooses, it can block any individual, any firm, any government institution, any entity, really whatsoever. It can block them from accessing their dollar-based wealth and freeze them out of the dollar payment system. So as you might imagine, the economic impact of that kind of a move can be pretty catastrophic for targets. So to sort of set the table with that, I would go back then to this question about what is de-dollarization and how is it related to sanctions? So in my preferred definition is something like this: the intentional reduction in a nation's reliance on the dollar for its international economic activities. I'll come back to sort of why I like that definition in a moment, but maybe it's worth asking, why would a government want to reduce its dependence on the dollar? Perhaps it's not self-evident yet. Well, right, for many countries that are interested in pursuing this goal, their motives are directly linked to concerns about the United States' use of sanctions, right? If holding my nation's wealth in dollars puts those assets at risk of being frozen by the U.S. government, then maybe I want to scale back how many dollars I'm holding in my reserves. Or if my major export industries rely on access to the dollar and U.S. banks to participate in international trade, and I'm worried that the U.S. government might cut my firms off from that network, well, maybe I look into alternative currencies, right, that I can use for those transactions. So one final point before I wrap up, I would say, you know, de-dollarization doesn't necessarily mean a complete elimination of the dollar in a country's economic relations, nor does it mean the end of global dollar dominance. And lately, I think that's how it's kind of being characterized sort of in the press and even by a lot of, you know, major financial institutions, where it's sort of like de-dollarization is synonymous with the dollar losing its dominant status. Where it is occurring, it's often incremental and usually only partial, because complete de-dollarization in today's world economy is pretty hard to achieve for even the most heavily sanctioned economies. So de-dollarization in most cases, in my view, is sort of a hedging exercise. It's, you know, preparing for that potential instance of sanctions in the future, or adapting to the current sanctions that you're facing. But it is real, it's happening, and it does have important implications for the U.S. and for the world.
We're seeing, you know, so much more attention on both sanctions evasion and this phenomenon of de-dollarization in the news. It's something that's in the headlines all the time now. But, you know, what's really interesting for me about your both of your scholarship and the research that you've done is that you've been looking at this long before it became sort of the subjects that were in the headlines on a daily basis. And Maria, I mean, I remember reading a paper that you wrote, I think back in 2020, that was titled Russia's Import Substitution and Its Pivot to Asia. And that was a paper that was interesting for me because my own research looking at Iran, there's a very similar phenomenon of a pivot to Asia. And in that paper, you describe how Asian firms were enabling circumvention of sanctions by Russia, which were imposed in response to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. What's really striking is that, of course, when we talk about Asian firms assisting Russian businesses in circumventing sanctions, you know, that is a phenomenon that's even more prevalent today. And we read a lot about China stepping in to support the Russian economy in the aftermath of Western sanctions. Tell us a little bit about how your research changed following the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and what has it meant for kind of the understanding and the importance of these issues?
No, absolutely. I've been working on this for the past 10 years. And in a way, the tactics for sanctions circumvention have not been, you know, new. We know them from Iranian cases, North Korean. They might have been more complex. There is more overlap with anti-money laundering. And there is definitely much more cooperation with sanctioned countries, as you said. Iranian drones end up on the Ukrainian battlefield, North Korean missiles. So there is more cooperation with heavily sanctioned jurisdiction, that's for sure. But in terms of tactics, I can't say that this is something brand new. So that poses the question, if sanctions circumvention is so high on Western policymakers' agenda, why is it so high, right? And that is sort of comes down to the point, to the key problem that homework hasn't been done since 2014 in terms of sanctions enforcement. So we have a barrage of sanctions, a lot of announcements of sanctions packages, but when it comes down to their robust enforcement, there have been a lot of loopholes and sort of repair works that needed to be done. So last year was really enforcement year, if you want, for Western jurisdictions, because they realized that is the weak spot in their sanctions regime. And a lot has been done actually on the sender state side, on sanctioning countries side. A lot of energy has been invested in enhanced interagency and international coordination. So the primary example here is probably the U.S. cooperation between kleptocapture and disruptive technology task forces, which has revealed quite a lot of procurement networks when it comes to Russia spanning third countries. The EU has unveiled its anti-circumvention tool. The UK has established Office of Trade Sanctions Implementation that will be operational this year. There have been plenty of joint visits to third countries, again, to prevent sanctions circumvention. And even on G7 level, right, there is an enforcement coordination mechanism which will bear some fruit, hopefully, this year or so. So a lot has changed, but again, tactics are not necessarily new, maybe more complex, but the gist of them should have been known to the policymaker a while ago.
Daniel, like Maria, you've also been working on your research topics for a long time, and de-dollarization being one of them. Back in 2015, you wrote an op-ed noting that an ascendant China was, quote, slowly working to revise foundational elements of the U.S.-led economic order. And you explained that this was in part by challenging the primacy of the dollar in the global economy. So it's clear that de-dollarization is this longer trend. I mean, you'd observed it a long time ago. But it's clear from the first pages of your book that, again, the Russian invasion of Ukraine appears to have really changed things when it comes to the trend line for de-dollarization. Tell us a bit about what changed. Is China working faster now on this kind of challenging of the U.S. dollar primacy?
Yeah, so you're totally right that this is a longer trend. And I actually want to start by kind of emphasizing that a little bit more. And then I'll come back at the end to this question about what sort of changed in the last 2 years. You know, I was virtually done with the book, right? So a book that's entirely trying to test this question of whether or not sanctions are linked to de-dollarization. I was virtually done with that when the Russian invasion of Ukraine began. So, you know, I would point out that like prior to the war, right, and for several years, at least prior to the war, as I was working on this book, central banks were already doing things like stocking up on gold reserves. Russia had already diversified its FX reserves out of dollars and was reducing its use of the dollar in trade with key partners, especially China. And China was already 7 years into the development of its own cross-border payments network called SIPS, based on its own banks and its own currency. So each of these moves, as well as others that I haven't mentioned, those were all driven in part or in whole by concerns about sanctions, concerns about the use of the dollar, right, as a coercive foreign policy tool. So, you know, one of the things that I heard a lot, especially in the initial weeks and months following the start of the war, especially the move to block the Central Bank of Russia's reserves, right, block their access from using those dollars and euros and other currencies, was that this was a moment that changed everything, that the United States had suddenly crossed this line for the first time by targeting a central bank. But in reality, and I know you know this, Yar, that we could go back as far as 1979. The United States initially freezes some of Iran's dollar assets, or 1987. The United States does this against Libya, 1990, against Iraq, 2010, Libya again. Like, the United States has done this before, right? And so you get my point, right? So yes, Russia was the first country to have its reserves frozen while the entire world was paying attention, right? That's the big difference, I think. But it most certainly wasn't the first country to have its reserves frozen. In fact, you can even look at right? Russian moves prior to the war, right? 2018 is this critical moment. There's a massive sort of package of U.S. sanctions that comes through that year. In April, the Central Bank of Russia responds by cutting its dollar holdings from roughly 45 down to 20% of its reserves. And that's before it was ever sanctioned. Why? Well, because Russian officials had seen the United States freeze the assets of other central banks, Libya, Iran, right? This is noted in the press, even by some Russian officials. They realized this was a risk given their fraught relations with the United States, given their designs on Ukraine. Rather than sit and wait for that to happen, they got ahead of that risk and preemptively de-dollarized. Now, back to your original question, I don't want to sort of overemphasize this point and suggest that 2022 doesn't matter. It does matter. It matters a lot, right? At the start of those sanctions, Russia is the 11th largest economy in the world, I believe. And the amount of reserves that were blocked were substantially larger than any previous case. And so, you know, the Russia case further demonstrates to the world that the United States not only has these capabilities and is willing to use them, but is willing to use them against, you know, great powers, if we want to call Russia a great power, right? And so countries like China that were already worried and already taking steps to insulate themselves, they took note of that, right? And they've intensified their efforts to reduce their own vulnerabilities. So yes, has China sort of sped up the pace? Yeah, sure. And they've done this in part by working with Russia to help Russia evade sanctions. So post 2022, we have seen, right, a notable boost in the use of China's currency, the RMB, in trade settlement. Much of this is with Russia, but not all of it. So while the Russia case wasn't what set all of this in motion in the first place, I would really strongly emphasize that, it has absolutely contributed to speeding up these developments.
That seems to go back a little bit to Maria's point about Western policymakers realizing things about sanctions and then having to adapt. So Maria, you described how basically, these tactics of sanction circumvention have been in place for a long time, but that only recently Western officials have maybe realized that they need to look back, look at those tactics, understand how they actually have to enforce these measures. Daniel, I mean, it seems like you're saying that the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the U.S. And Western sanctions imposed against Russia were more of a sort of tipping point for Western officials than they were for officials in the countries targeted by sanctions, because Russian, Chinese, Iranian officials have sort of understood over a longer period of time that, you know, they were vulnerable to this kind of pressure and had been working longer term to prepare themselves. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think so. What do you mean? I guess I'll just ask, what do you mean by a tipping point for Western officials? If you could clarify your thinking there.
Maybe just that, you know, they suddenly realized that the scale at which they would be engaged in this economic warfare and the responsibilities that go alongside that. And Maria, I'm interested to know what you think about this. But, you know, it seems like U.S. officials maybe were applying sanctions, not realizing over the years that they were contributing to a shift in the strategic thinking of some of the targeted countries about how long-term they should be working around things like getting very good at sanctions circumvention and also getting in a position where they're less dependent on the dollar.
I would say in the cat and mouse sanctions game, the targets will always be ahead, basically. They have more investments, more commitment, more determination. So it's really hard for sanctioning states to go after them. You really have to plug every loophole, every shell company, you name it. And that's hard. Especially with the complex Russia sanctions. So in my research or my conversations with policymakers, there is always lagging understanding to look at the target side, to really look what they are doing actually, because sanctions are expanded quite often at large scale speed, but it's quite often, again, one step behind what the target is doing.
And Maria, before I turn back to Daniel, I mean, can you explain a little bit about the connection between sanctions circumvention and de-dollarization? I mean, these are two separate things, but they're very related. I mean, is it the case that the need to circumvent sanctions or the failure to effectively circumvent sanctions drives more de-dollarization? And is successful de-dollarization a way to make sanctions circumvention more possible because you have alternate financial channels? How are they related?
No, absolutely. I would say the financial dimension is central to sanctions circumvention. Unless you're engaged in some sort of barter-like arrangements, and plenty of those as well, you still need to pay for those goods and services that are affected by sanctions. So even heavily sanctioned jurisdictions are struggling which financial channels to choose to actually do your sanctions circumvention, simply because currency and financial infrastructure matters. Why does it matter? I know you have done podcast on weaponized interdependence, and that is one reason why it matters. Because through SWIFT, through correspondent banking, the US used the dollar preeminence and its control over the financial plumbing system to impose these financial sanctions on adversaries, ranging from Iran, North Korea, Russia, and so on. And it offered a very quick and efficient way to target individuals and companies with the immediate impact and rather great precision. So for countries like Russia, but also with China in mind, there is this drive to go away from the dollar-centered financial infrastructure. De-dollarization is a way, as an adaptation, to lessen the sanctions pressure, but also to enhance tactics for sanctions circumvention. So Russia has conducted a three-tier de-dollarization strategy. It has de-dollarized its foreign reserves. It has created alternatives to SWIFT and Visa and MasterCards. And it has shifted away to local currencies, mainly rubles and yuan, in cross-border payments, simply to avoid U.S. nexus. There are mixed results on all of these tiers, simply because it's hard to, as Daniel pointed out, hard to get away from the dollar entirely. But it can be quite handy to scale your sanctions circumvention tactics. And now we're currently observing yuanization of Russia's financial system. A lot of trade with China is done in rubles and yuan, replacing dollar and euro. And also companies, Russian companies, are increasingly pivoting to yuan-denominated bonds, or even the households are now opening accounts in yuan as opposed to the dollar.
Daniel, I mean, going back to that tipping point question, I'll actually draw an example from your book. So in Bucking the Buck, you write about sort of the reaction to the Western sanctions levied against Russia. And you cite the cast of characters that were suddenly very concerned about the possible impact on the global financial system. You mention Gita Gopinath of the IMF, Zoltan Pozsar, a sort of influential and prolific writer and thinker who is an analyst at Credit Suisse, and then the Financial Times columnist Martin Wolf, as all being individuals who, you know, were writing in that period saying, okay, what are we doing to the global financial system? So it seems like officials and business leaders in countries targeted by sanctions knew very well how they wanted to maybe evolve the global financial system. I think Maria just did a great explanation about the connection between sanction circumvention and de-dollarization. So, I mean, was the blowback that you saw and this sort of, you know, the commentariat and policymakers getting worried, I mean, is it fair to call that a kind of tipping point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was also further accelerated by the fact that Russia, as I hinted at earlier, and Maria has also made some of these points, right? Russia already had some experience with preparing for this. And so in one sense, they were, I don't want to say they were ready for everything, but they were ready for more than, you know, than a lot of these past countries that had been heavily sanctioned were. So you could go back to the Obama years, right, when Russia first is hit with sanctions in 2014. For the annexation of Crimea. And that wasn't the end of it, right? There were additional U.S. sanctions packages that were rolled out in 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018 for all kinds of different offenses. It wasn't all Ukraine related. Sometimes it was human rights violations, cyber attacks against the United States, of course, famously meddling in the 2016 election, and yes, more Ukraine related activities as well. So, you know, Russia was already sort of adapting. It hadn't gone to the level it has now, and maybe we'll come back to that in a second. But they were working with the Chinese, and they were working even to some extent with the Indians and even the Europeans, right? Quite interestingly, to de-dollarize in certain sectors. So, you know, I sort of walk through in carefully detail in the book. So anyone who's interested in that can, you know, read the full backstory there. But it matters. It matters because in 2022, right, that I think helps Russia adapt more quickly to the financial pressure that was applied following the invasion. So we can take a quick look at what Russia has done over the last 2 years. And a lot of this is, we're going to reference things that Maria already talked about, but we can, I think, emphasize it a little more to see how quickly this has turned, right? Russia in 2021, at the start of the war, you know, based on their central bank data, used the dollar for about half of their international trade settlement. They had already brought that down to that 50% number from 80% in 2014. So that's sort of that pre-invasion progress I was talking about. Since 2022, February of 2022, over the last 2 years, that's been cut down to around 13%. That's according to numbers that the CBR has spoken about and Putin himself. In the meantime, the use of the ruble, as Maria mentioned already, that has boomed from, in 2022, around 15%. Now it's up to 35% of trade settlement for Russia's overall trade. And China's currency, the RMB, is really what has gained the most, from 3% up to 35%. So that's the kind of adaptation that we're talking about here. And that's just in sort of the trade settlement channel. So I think the key takeaway here, right, for me in terms of this being, you know, a game changer, so to speak, right, is that Russia has been able to really reshape its international first commercial network, right? You know, it's not trading with Europe much anymore, right? That's been replaced with trade with China, with India, with Turkey, and other countries. And it's been able to maintain those commercial ties despite sanctions because it's been able to reshape its international financial connections with those countries and avoid dollar transactions, rely on local currency, rely on SIPs, rely on its own messaging system, SBFS, for instance, and so on. So I'm not suggesting that those alternatives, I want to be clear about this, are comparable to the dollar system or as desirable as the dollar system, right? They're much smaller and they're inferior in just about every way. But when you're backed into a corner, and Russia certainly has been backed into a corner by the sanctions, and you have no alternative, they're proving capable of keeping Russia afloat and sort of allow it to sort of defy expectations. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
So there are two things there that stick out to me. I mean, one is you have to wonder whether some of these trends and the shift to move away from the dollar actually in hindsight were leading indicators that, you know, we were headed for some kind of deeper conflict. But the other thing that comes to mind is, you know, Russia managing in the face of the sanctions has really perplexed me as someone that works on a country like Iran, where you know, the Iran sanctions continue to be, in some respects, much stronger than the sanctions imposed on Russia. And Maria, I'm curious to sort of understand from you, you know, you speak to European and U.S. officials frequently as part of your role at IISS, and it looks like, in some ways, concerns over de-dollarization and creating shocks for the global financial system may have limited the strength of the sanctions imposed on Russia, maybe most notably with the fact that, you know, Russia faces a price cap on its oil exports, whereas a country like Iran faces full secondary sanctions on the energy exports. What are officials telling you when you talk to them about how they're trying to balance the need to have tough sanctions on Russia, limit its economy, and force those sanctions with the need to try and keep the global economy moving in a way that doesn't maybe accelerate de-dollarization?
Despite being the most sanctioned country in the world, Russia doesn't face a maximum pressure campaign like we've seen with Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and Syria. And that comes down to two factors. First, it's very different exposure. It's a G20 economy. It's much deeper embedded into the global economy. It's a major commodity exporter. So unintended consequences is really high on policymakers' agenda. And the second one related to that is unwillingness to bear high costs, which comes with sanctions that are much harder than the ones we currently have. So that comes with challenges in terms of sanctions design. How to create a sanctions design that doesn't impose too much cost on the sender states and yet to somehow increase pressure on Russia to erode its ability to fund the war and to change its Ukraine policy. So we have very tailored measures as part of smart sanctions concept. Yet it's very difficult, right, to sanction an economy that is so well integrated and that sort of poses a challenge for any China sanctions. And as you mentioned, two examples here where unintended consequences have been key on policymakers' mind. It's the price cap, where the idea was not to exclude Russian energy altogether, Russian oil from energy markets altogether, but to come up with some clever mechanism based on cartel buyers' idea that you still allow Russian oil to the markets, yet it's set under a certain price cap, and the G7 insurance would be the key leverage here. And the key idea was to mitigate any unintended consequences for third countries, and particularly in the global south. And the second one where you see these concerns about unintended consequences is de-dollarization when it comes to seizing Russian sovereign assets, right? There are a lot of legal debates, but the economic one revolves around that any step like that would really have unintended consequences for the position of the dollar and the euro as a foreign reserve currencies. So unintended consequences is really a part of sanctions design and part of the smart sanctions concept.
And Maria, I mean, building on that, it seems like another aspect of having smart sanctions is to have sanctions that are designed in a collaborative or cooperative way. You wrote a piece last year where you argued for the importance of what you call sanctioning coalitions and highlighted that, you know, whereas the Russia sanctions program maybe hasn't been dependent on secondary sanctions and isn't sort of really backed by just the U.S. imposing those kinds of sanctions that would affect the activities of third countries, rather, there's been an effort to, quote, invest time and energy in cooperation and coordination. Why does a cooperative approach matter in this environment? And what is it about, you know, trying to build a coalition that will make or break the Russia sanctions program?
I would say for those who study sanctions and export controls, Rule 101, multilateral cooperation matters. It's really a necessary factor for sanctions or export control effectiveness. But I would say until Russia's invasion of Ukraine, until the Russian case, it was really not much investment done in terms of building the sanctioning or export control coalitions. And that comes down to the fact that key multilateral fora as the UN Security Council and the Wassenaar arrangements for export controls are now de facto blocked by Russia. So many things cannot be done. So you have to invest a lot of time, a lot of energy into assembling these coalitions, right? The Biden administration did more than 180 meetings only in 2022, and I think only the beginning of 2022. So we've seen this rise of ad hoc coalition building and rise to autonomous measures, and different fora have emerged in terms of gathering different countries, Russia-related or not Russia-related. G7 have really become this important peer pressure platform for maybe ambivalent countries to really join the effort. And it has really become this platform to brainstorm measures such as the price cap or ban on Russian diamonds. And it has become this driving force to really think with peers in the West, but also in Asia. US and Japan, together with South Korea, have also established platforms for export control coordination. We have US-EU TTC, Trade and Technology Council. So those are the examples where coalitions are emerging outside of the multilateral organizations. And I would say the two measures that have played the most role in terms of surprising Russia have involved big sanctioning coalitions. And that is the fact that Russia didn't expect the Europeans and the Japanese joining freezing of the Russian central bank's asset and export controls. More than 27 states joined export controls, including Taiwan and South Korea, where Russia used to outsource its production. So these are the examples where sanction and coalition matters in terms of coercing Russia in some sort of meaningful way. So if we look ahead, as the world becomes more fragmented and multipolar, Western countries will continue to seek out these value-based coalitions and issue specific alignments to enact economic sanctions and export controls. But that comes down with coalition management. It requires more time and energy to coordinate measures. It comes down with challenges for harmonization of those measures. Trade-offs and concessions will be part of that. And we know with the example on chips with the US, the Netherlands and Japan, how hard it can be to actually align your national interest. Also, there are risks of adopting something lukewarm where there is a low common denominator when it comes to these big sanctioned coalitions. So Russia and China face a different challenge, right? They might not have the same type of allies, but one can argue that they still have these sanctioned bodies that can be quite handy. They have formed the so-called sanctioned club. They might not work as the US-led alliance in the West, but they can still be helpful. It's a transactional, opportunistic nature of this cooperation. It's not based on any values necessarily. It's not highly institutionalized. But what these countries can offer each other is actually more agile and swifter because it doesn't involve any decision-making that is linked to democratic processes. And the latest example is when North Korea quickly arranged the deal with Russia arms for oil. So you could see that there will be challenges, but also opportunities building these coalitions on both sides of the sanctioned warfare.
I think that's a perfect segue to my next question, because often when we read about news coverage of, you know, evaluating the sanctioning coalition and then the club of sanctioned countries, it's like there are two teams and we're trying to figure out which team is likely to win the game and where should we put our bets. And I mean, Daniel, there's a question that I know our listeners will want answered, which is basically, what team do you expect to succeed? I mean, you wrote in your book that the dollar will remain king, and that was sort of your prediction. I'm curious to know whether you still stand by that and whether you think that the coalition of sanctioning countries, as described by Maria, is going to come out ahead in this cat and mouse game compared to the countries that are experiencing sanctions or trying to circumvent that sanctions power.
Man, I think my answer depends on what we're defining as victory in this case. So, you know, victory is, getting Russia to back down from its designs on Ukraine and give back, right, all territory that it's taken. And in other words, for the sanctions to sort of work in the traditional way we think of sanctions working. I wouldn't bet on that, right? But if by win you mean these sanctioned states that are all grumpy about the dollar are going to somehow, right, completely create an alternative system that replaces all the functions that the dollar system does with minimal losses in efficiency and so forth, I wouldn't bet on that either, right? I think what I would say is I would expect that the sanctioned countries, Russia, China, Iran, the other countries that are worried about this, you know, we'll continue to sort of, in one sense, muddle along. You know, I talk about it in the book, how their responses so far have largely been ad hoc and uncoordinated. I think it's getting a little more coordinated, a little less ad hoc, but it's still not, you know, a full coalition with an organized, as Maria said, institutionalized response. And it's clearly based on sort of each country's individual interests, right? I think what it's really lacking here is a country in terms of the sanctioned state side, is a country that's willing to stand up and be the leader and provide sort of like public goods for the countries that are upset about sort of the dollar's reign and its coercive capabilities. So, you know, China is the closest thing there is to the leader in this group. But China's actions are, again, primarily self-serving, primarily about defending its own interests. And so it's working with Russia, right? It's certainly helping the Russians. But overall, its efforts to promote RMB internationalization, again, focused mostly in trade settlement, cross-border payments, is really about making sure that China has the plumbing in place that's functioning in case it faces, right, Russia-style sanctions in the future. Its interest in doing this is really about self-preservation, autonomy, its own resilience. Less interested in sort of promoting the RMB as a currency for trade settlement between third countries, and definitely not interested in creating, you know, an alternative reserve currency to the dollar. I mean, that's the biggest thing, right? You know, certainly Russia has invested more heavily in RMB reserves. It has no choice, right? Because it doesn't have any alternatives these days. But, you know, the Chinese are focused primarily on stability, economic stability, financial stability. Really trying to promote their currency as an alternative to the dollar would mean liberalizing, opening up the mainland financial markets to foreign investment. That means exposing yourself to foreign capital flows, which can be destabilizing, sometimes crisis-inducing. And so I don't expect we'll see, you know, that develop either. So, you know, I think we'll just see more of the same small continued gains for, right, the RMB and for perhaps other sort of local currencies among sort of small bilateral relationships. So yes, more incremental de-dollarization that will weaken the impact of U.S. sanctions over time, financial sanctions over time. I think that is the biggest threat. I don't think we're going to see the toppling of the dollar, especially because of these considerations and these moves, in part because, again, I don't see, you know, the alternative leader that's willing to sort of provide all of the functions of an international currency that the United States has been doing for the last 80 plus years.
Maria, I want to get your sort of take on this too. I mean, Daniel makes it sound like what really matters here is the coalition management that you talked about and whether or not you have a leader like the US or more of a reluctant leader in the case of China when it comes to the potential club of sanctioned countries. I mean, how do you see the two coalitions and who do you expect to sort of come out ahead in the medium to long term?
It's hard to predict, but as I said, those are different nature coalitions, if you want. They have different opportunities and challenges. On the one hand, value-based coalition in the West are more robust, more flexible, so they can respond to things with maybe more resolve. But on the other hand, the sanctions club composed of heavily sanctioned jurisdiction can be quicker in terms of conducting the deals, right? They don't need to be responsible to their electorates. They can conclude those deals rather quickly. But what they don't have is innovation, capital, investment. So they will remain on this low level of exchange, what they can offer to each other, mainly to teach each other how to circumvent sanctions. But those are not the examples of, you know, thriving economies as we see them in the West.
So we've come to the end of our time, which means I have to ask you each the question that we ask all of our guests. Maria, I'll start with you. Tell me, when did you realize that sanctions were changing the world?
Changing the world is a big ask to sort of define here. I would say, having been working on sanctions since 2014, two things struck me the most is when the EU imposed sectoral sanctions on Russia after the shutting down of MH17 and the seizing of central bank's asset. It's not necessarily has changed the world, but it has changed the relationship with Russia. It has changed the mindset from the sender state perspective. And I think that's the beginning factor where you can win economic warfare.
And Daniel, same question.
I can give you the exact date for me, so I can be pretty precise. August 3rd, 2017. The only reason I know that is I could go back to the file that I saved that day, and I could see the day that the file was created. And that happened to be the day that I somehow stumbled across the text of this speech by then Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. It had been given a little more than a year earlier in 2016. I missed it at the time. Again, somehow August of 2017, I stumbled across it. The title of the speech was "The Evolution of Sanctions and Lessons for the Future." I read the thing and sort of the light bulb went off in my head. And that was the article where Lew is basically saying the more the United States uses sanctions, right, what the consequence of this is, it's going to push targeted countries to look for alternative currencies. And sort of that was the thing that launched the idea. Hey, maybe I could do a project, maybe even a book project on this. I saved it. I filed it away. And in that same file over the next, you know, 5 years, the rest of the book sort of populated. So that was it for me.
On the episode with Saleha Mohsin, we realized that both of us had that speech bookmarked on our browsers. That's a good answer and a speech that everyone should go back to. Daniel, thanks so much for coming onto the show.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Maria, great to have you in this conversation.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
I'm Esfandyar Batmagelij, and this has been The Sanctions Age. Our show is produced by Spiritland Productions and is supported by a grant from the Halling Center for International Dialogue. Thanks for listening.